Today I wanted to talk a little bit about our sutra, the identity of absolute and relative that we read earlier today in the sutra service. And it's just a few reflections on some of the lines. It's not meant to be a comprehensive treatise on the sutra. So the sutra is also known as Sandokai, and it was written by Sekito Kisen. That's the Japanese name. Or Shoto Shichrin, I think that's, not quite sure about the pronunciation, but something like that. And he lived in 8th century China. And in those days in China, so when it starts with the mind of the great sage of India, so that was Buddha, was intimately conveyed from west to east, so it came from India to China. Though people may be sharp-witted or dull, there is no north and south in the way. And so in the 8th century, Zen in China had divided into two schools. So there was the northern school and the southern schools. And the northern schools believed more in gradual enlightenment, so having a long practice, so the idea of polishing the mirror, working hard, and then eventually having a breakthrough. And the southern school believed more in sudden enlightenment. And Sekito Kisen wrote this poem or sutra as a way of wanting to go beyond the different schools and to come to more fundamental understanding rather than being caught up in differences between the different schools. And so the idea of having an absolute reality and a relative reality is a real key understanding in Buddhism, and how, you know, the relationship between the two, between the absolute and relative, different schools of Buddhism have different understandings, how that works. Another way of thinking about it is form and emptiness, which is in the Heart Sutra. So the idea that form is in emptiness and emptiness is in form. Relative reality is seen as the here and now, so this is our body, and this morning I had breakfast, and then I drove here, and now I'm here in this room as Anya, so that's the relative. And there's also an absolute reality, which is our interdependence with everything else that is around us. Another way we could look at that is the difference between individualism and interdependence. And basically, it's not like one or the other. So every aspect of being contains the two. So we are always individuals and we're always interdependent. We are always in absolute reality and relative reality. But the way we live our lives, we could have either extreme individualism or extreme just merging with everything around us and not having much sense of self. And some societies are much more geared towards one or the other. But basically, whenever we come to one of those extremes, it's not healthy. It's very unbalanced and becomes quickly problematic. So the understanding of being interdependent is, you know, it's really basic understanding, so that we don't exist, we, you know, by ourselves. We had to rely on our parents and our teachers. And then to get to work, we have to rely on the train drivers or, you know, someone building roads for us. To eat, we have to rely on farmers. For the traffic to flow, we have to rely on someone looking at spreadsheets and working out better traffic flow, scientists. And I tried to look at how many different jobs there are in Australia. I'm not sure if this is the correct number, but one number came up with 12,000 different career options. So it's a lot, you know. And the amazing thing is that mostly everyone, yeah, someone finds a job in one of those 12,000 different careers, and it's kind of fairly balanced much of the time. So it's pretty amazing to think about it like that. Then there's also the line of each element comes back to its own nature, just as a child finds its own mother. Fire is hot, the wind blows, water is wet and earth solid. So we are also interdependent on nature, of course, as well. So we rely on air, and with air we rely on trees giving us oxygen, and we give them carbon dioxide back. Then water we rely on, and that has to go through natural cycles as well, and eventually come down as rain, and then we drink it and it goes back again. also the nutrients from the earth, because we all started our lives as a tiny little sperm meeting a tiny little egg, and that's all we had. And everything else in our body and who we are was actually comes directly from the earth through the micronutrients and the macronutrients. So we are completely earth, made from earth. And then also the warmth, so the fire. As warm-blooded mammals, we rely on the warmth of the sun, again, directly and indirectly, through the food we burn and the sun we receive. And one of the amazing things about our life is that our planet happens to be exactly the right distance from the sun for us to be able to flourish. So if it was closer, it would be too hot. A little bit further away, it would be far too cold for us. And then we are always interconnected with all of that. So eyes see forms, ears hear sounds, noses smell, tongues tell salty from sour. So it is with everything everywhere. So we are constantly receiving sensory inputs, and so the world is acting on us, and then we are reacting to the world based on those sensory inputs. So we are very much interdependent, but we are also very much individuals. So if you're sitting and you're in pain, then I can't feel your pain, that is your pain. And you're sitting in meditation and I can't experience your meditation, that is your meditation. And we even know for siblings, you know, growing up in the same family with the same similar experiences, same parents, can have very different perceptions of what that family was about and what's actually happening. So, yeah. Again, the sense of the interdependence is reality, but also the individualism is also a reality. And during the pandemic, some of those assumptions were sort of often challenged in terms of how we perceive ourselves as individuals. And so some people became very mindful of, this is who I am and these are my rights and my freedoms. And then other people were, had more of a sense, oh, I need to keep other people safe, so I'm going to follow these restrictions. And so that sense of having some rights and having responsibilities. And again, there's a sort of spectrum of being very conscious of our rights or being very conscious of our responsibility. And different cultures have different emphasis there again. So some are very much strong on the individual freedoms, others much more, you know, sense of community. And of course, sometimes we can also get lost in that sense obligation towards family or towards community, and there's less emphasis on the individual person and what might, they might be wanting. For instance, in Zen, we're all wearing black here, and that's a sense of, you know, being community, but some people might think, oh, you know, I want to be able to wear what I want to wear. And I know that for some people that's actually a deal breaker, you know, I can't do Zen because I can't wear black, it's just not my colour. So yes, people have very different perceptions of that. In Buddhism, it's really important to sort of have an understanding of how we perceive the world and how the sensory inputs and then our mind construct our perception of reality. So, and then how some of our perceptions or constructs are delusions. So the idea that we, the way we interact with life and the way we perceive things are actually often quite deluded. So the perception and the mind has quite an important role in Buddhism, but it has to do with how we interpret reality. It's not about creating reality. So even though our mind has quite a strong part to play, we are still subject to sickness, aging, and death. So sometimes, you know, when you read certain Buddhist phrases, it might sound sort of absolute and, you know, almost getting a little bit to that magical thinking, oh, you're creating your reality. Things like in The Secret, you know, your mind creates your reality, and that's not part of Buddhism at all. But on the other hand, there is a sense that it's not just responding to reality, but that the mind also plays an influence on how we live our lives. And so in our worldview, we live both in the relative, which is our life here and now, in this time and space and this sense of self, and also the absolute. So the understanding that we don't actually have an independently existing self and that countless causes and conditions have come together to create who we are. And so in this poem, it's, or the sutra, it's phenomena accord with the fundamental as a lid fits its box. the fundamental meets phenomena like arrows in mid-air. So basically they're just together, they're not separated at all. So Dogen, who's, you know, very influential in our Zen practice, so he said practice and enlightenment are one. And he very much said this not a step-by-step sort of process. So there's one step where you are a deluded being, and then the next step you're a Buddha. And so that's an absolute way of understanding, but there's also the relative idea of practicing Zazen and some people having a more developed understanding than others. And there's a Soto Zen priest who's done a lot of teaching in America called Shohaku or Kimura. And he had a really nice line. So he studied Dogen a lot. And he said, with this body and mind, we sit in both individuality and universality. So I'll read that again. With this body and mind, we sit in both individuality and universality. And so one of the ideas, again, in Buddhism is what's called the three marks of existence. So there's anicca, which is impermanence, and the understanding that nothing lasts forever. And of course, in some ways we know that, but on another level we tend to resist that understanding. And then there's dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering, but can also be seen as the unsatisfactory nature of existence, which basically is, you know, even if you're happy now, tomorrow you'll be unhappy. If you love someone, they're going to die, you're going to die. So, you know, so that's the sort of underlying challenge that we have as living, that, you know, everything. It's not that life is only suffering, but that the suffering is inevitable when we live life, and so that's unsatisfactory. And then anatta, that sense of no self, which basically doesn't mean that we don't have a self, but there's no unchanging permanent self. And so that the illusion of a separate permanent self is what actually leads to suffering. And so the absolute is in the relative, and the relative is in the absolute. So it's not binary, but how we live it out could be a spectrum in how we interpret the world, and different Buddhism, schools of Buddhism and other different ways of, philosophies and other religions have different ways of sort of perceiving this. And generally speaking, when we're just living our day-to-day life, we may not be very conscious of where we actually sit on that spectrum between the absolute way of living life or more relative, until we come to some sort of crisis, or we study Buddhism, or we have a spiritual experience. Because when we are used to the worldview, then we just sort of take it for granted. But when we are challenged in our worldview in some way, or we consciously study something like Buddhism, then we might realize, actually, this is, you know, this is how I perceive the world, and I'm really stuck in this way or the other way. I'm very interdependent, very individualistic. We get more of an understanding of how we actually perceive the world and how that then leads us to actions. And so a challenge for us is, as Shohaku Okamura said, can we sit with this body in mind, in both individuality and universality?